Good morning, Mike Whitney. How are you?
Hey, Jared. How you going, mate? Hello, Lars. Hello, Pop.
Whit, how
Hello,
are
buddy.
You, my friend?
Good, mate. How are you?
Mate, we're great. And it's great to have you on the show. And I want to start, actually. I know you're a proud South Sydney boy, so you're a life member at the Bunnies. Have you got over the grand final yet?
Oh, always disappointing to lose a grand final. You know, we'd played pretty well to get in there. I think our grand final was the week before. The ball just went our way in that sort of grand final decider type thing to get into the grand final. And then it just didn't go our way sort of in the grand final. But, yeah, disappointing, but, you know, that's the way it goes. We'd rather be playing in the grand final than not making it. So look forward to next year.
Whit, lovely to speak to you, buddy. Mate, good timing as well. We're doing a lot of talking to club coaches and grade cricketers at the moment on this show, and it's been really nice to spend a bit of time hearing their thoughts and seeing the guys back playing grade cricket. Mate, you are as loyal as they come when we talk about how important club cricket is, and I'm really keen to get your thoughts on where you see the game of cricket right now, and do you still believe grade cricket and club cricket has that significance and importance?
Oh, absolutely, Pop. I mean, I always talk and have been a big fan of trying to get the first-class players and test players back into playing test cricket. In my day, when I got into first grade in 1979...
A couple of years ago?
I know, mate. It's unbelievable when I think about that. But look, when I... Every Sheffield Shield player, every test player, they all came back. They all played. There were times in my cup first year of playing first grade for Randwick that you'd play an opposition side and they had two or three of those players. We had Alan Turner, Ron Crippen, John Dyson, and a couple of us went on to play Sheffield Shield cricket. And you just learnt so much from those guys. You learnt everything about the game, and it prepared you if you were lucky enough to play for New South Wales. I know the program's much heavier for the international players and the first-class players. There was no T20 in my day, all this sort of stuff. So I'm a big advocate of that, but grade cricket is so important. I made the decision when I retired in 1994 to go back to clubland, and I went back to sort of Randwick and got on the committee there, and then 21 seasons ago, we merged with Petersham Marrickville to create Randwick Petersham, and they asked me to be the president. And jokingly, I said I'd do it for a couple of years. I've been the president for 21 years now. And not too many are holding their hand up to take the job off me. But look, I just thought it was important that I went back and with the new club as well, Randwick Petersham, tried to have a bit of stewardship over that to try and direct the club in the right way and put the right foundations in the ground. And we've been fairly successful. But again, there's always something to do, you know. There's always trying to encourage the players. Of course, we're trying to get a female team in the competition as well, so that's adding another string to our bow. And hasn't the girls' game just gone up like a rocket into the sky? I mean, just amazing watching the girls play. So, yes, big advocate for club and grade cricket, and it should be your preparation for moving into the first-class scene.
Where did it all start for you, mate? Or how did it all start? And when did you realise that you had some ability then? You thought, oh, geez, I can make a career out of this.
Well, I've got to tell you, mate, I was a rugby league tragic and I played until I was 20. And that was really my first preference. I grew up in Matraville, which is a suburb behind Maroubra Beach.
Yep.
And that's in the heart of Rabbitohs territory. My father was an old Mascot East Lakes person, again, heart of Rabbitohs territory. So from a very young age, my sister were indoctrinated into the Rabbitohs family, and we've been like that ever since. Plus, around where I was living, Georgie Piggins lived around there, Ronnie Coote lived around there, John O'Neill and Gary Stevens were builders. They had a building business, and you would see them around the local suburbs working on houses. And my old man would come home. He was a truck driver out at Boral Oil Refinery, and he'd say, I know Lurch O'Neill and Steve are working on a house in Chifley, and I'd jump in the car and we'd drive past the place just to look at them working on the house. So that was my love. There was a lot of sport around my area, and we played rugby league in the winter, cricket in the summer, and went down the beach at Maroubra and spent a lot of time down there surfing. It wasn't until I was 17 and I'd been playing cricket on the mats in the South Sydney Juniors competition just with my mates. And I dusted up a couple of people on the mats, getting a bit quicker. And this one guy I didn't know, he's an older gentleman, he played first grade for Randwick and made double centuries in first grade. And he rang the secretary of Randwick Cricket Club and said, there's a 17-year-old maniac with the afro, the big afro, running around in the juniors, and you should ring him up. Anyway, this guy, Lyle Gardner, started ringing my house, and I was going down the beach on Saturday morning, surfing and playing cricket in the Arvo. And one morning, I was 10 minutes late from leaving, and my mum answered the phone, and Lyle Gardner, this gentleman, again asked someone had pulled out of a fourth-grade game. There was only four grades in those days. And my mother said, you'll go and play this game. This Mr. Gardner won't ring the house again. So I got on my bike and pedalled up to Snape and played a fourth-grade game. Took 4 for 16.
My God.
And that moment, that fourth-grade game changed my whole perception of cricket. I'd played very few games on turf wickets. Everybody was in long whites. It was really, even though it was only fourth grade, it was really formal and really professional to me that everybody had long whites, long sleeve shirts, you know, jumpers, spikes on, we're playing on turf. And that moment changed my game, my mind. So I played a few more years of rugby league and then got really serious about the cricket when I sort of got into second and first grade.
We're talking to Mike Whitney, who's our Friday legend, and well, we're ahead with the Ashes series. Yeah. And you made your test debut in what, the fifth test in Manchester in 1981. So tell us the process then of, I guess, getting onto that tour and making your debut.
I'd actually debuted for New South Wales the season after I played my first grade season, which was a whirlwind. I'd had a great first season for Randwick and got in the state squad and found myself in the side. So I played four Shield games, three Shield games and a touring game against New Zealand. But like most cricketers in those days, wanted to go to England and play Lancashire League. And some of my mates had played up in the Northern League in Lancashire around Blackpool and hooked me up with this club. So I went there to play for Fleetwood. Out of nowhere, about a third of the way through the season, I had another mate from Newcastle, Greg Geese, who I was in the stateside with. He was on a scholarship at Gloucester, and a couple of their quicks had been injured and they were looking for someone to fill in for a few games. And one of those quicks was the great South African Mike Proctor. So I went down and trialled with Gloucester, and they actually signed me up, and I played a few first-class games with them. The tour was on. The Ashes tour was on. It was a great tour. It ended up being called Botham's Ashes. And just prior to the fifth test, I get this phone call. I'm playing for Gloucester, and this voice says to me on the phone, you've been picked, because I knew Jeff Lawson and Rod Hogg were under an injury cloud, because I'd followed the series. I was in England. It was an amazing series to be watching. That's where Beefy went crazy at Headingley and Bob Willis took 8 for, and all these amazing things were happening. So this bloke on the phone says, you're being picked for the test match. Grab your gear, leave Cheltenham and come to Manchester. And I told him to F off. Because I thought it was a G-up. I thought it was a mate of mine G-ing up, and hung the phone up. He rang back and he went, this is Fred Bennett, the manager of the Australian cricket team. Yeah, and, you know, leave now. Mind you, Malcolm Marshall was bowling for Hampshire and taking shreds off us, so I was pretty happy to get the pads off and get in their car and drive to Manchester, and I debuted the next day in the fifth test at Old Trafford, which was, again, it was like a dream. It was surreal. Mm. It was surreal. So that changed my life as well. That very moment changed my whole life.
What about that era of cricket and, you know, Australia going through some tough periods? And again, we sit here right now talking about who's going to be the next Australian captain and how important, you know, that role, how significant that role is in any, you know, certainly in any Australian or first-class cricket team. But for you to play under, you know, guys like Alan Border, how important was that for you? And did you see the Australian captain, you know, in that esteem that we sit here and talk about how important it is to pick the right person?
Oh, absolutely. And my captain for those first two tests was Kim Hughes.
Yeah.
And when I actually got to Manchester, Fred Bennett, the manager, said, come straight up to this particular room, room 252, and I'll meet you there. And I went up there and knocked on the door, opened the door, and Fred was there. And I actually knew Fred from Sydney. He was from the Balmain Cricket Club. he was on New South Wales Cricket Association board. He might have been the chairman, actually. And Kim Hughes was sitting in the room. And I'd only met him once in a game I was 12th man in Sydney against Western Australia. And I went, oh. And I said, oh, Kim, I didn't know whether to call him captain or bow or do whatever, because they were held in that esteem. I mean, and, you know, the captain before him was Greg Chappell and Ian Chappell. I mean, these guys were just absolute legends. And to Kim's credit, and I've always thanked him for this, he said to me, this is going to be a big deal because you're playing tomorrow. And I looked at him and went, what? He said, we've got enough people to carry the drinks, mate. We're taking a third seamer into this game, and you're going to be bowling first change after Dennis Lilly and Terry Alderman take ball. Well, DK was God, and Rod Marsh was playing. And so, and he said to me at that moment, anything you need ever 24/7 while you're with this side, I'm available. You ring me, you talk to me, anything you need. So that was great, and he was absolutely fantastic to me. I played in that test match, took 2 and 2. We lost that game, which was a bummer, and actually lost the Ashes. But they kept me on with the tour, played a couple of first-class games, a one-dayer, and then we played the sixth test at the Oval, and I played in that game as well. And Dirk Wellham, my New South Wales teammate, debuted in that game and made 100 on debut. So it was a whirlwind, amazing season, which changed my life. But Kim Hughes was fantastic. Pup, you mentioned Alan Border.
Yeah.
Oh, man, by the time I got to play under Alan, he was just a legend, tough, uncompromising. Look, when I played under Alan and I spent sort of the back end of the 80s and the early 90s till I retired, in and out of the side, but I played in the World Cup in 92 and a lot of one-day games, all under Alan. He was injured once, and I played one game under Mark Taylor. But, mate, if Alan had said to any of us in the team, jump up, we instantly would have gone how high and how many times.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just... Look, Michael, you captained Australia in, what, 47 tests, I think? You know what it's like. You've got to be the boss. Yeah. You've got to be tough. You've got to be resilient. You've got to deal with the press. You've got to deal with life. You've got to have support around you. Moving on to who's going to be the new captain. Wow, what a big job. What a time to come in to captain the side. Is it going to be Patrick? Is it going to be Stephen? Does Stephen really want to do it again? I mean, he's free now to just go out and play. We've never had fast bowlers as captains in this country. That'd be a first for Patrick. It's a really big moment for Australian cricket.
What's the biggest challenge he would face with? You're a former fast bowler. Like, Pat Cummins, the captain, versus Pat Cummins, the bowler, just worrying about his bowling, trying to combine the two. How difficult in your mind would that be?
Very, very, for me, very tough. I just needed to focus and concentrate on my game and my role and my position in the side and make sure that I do that. The captain's across everything. I mean, and I think traditionally we haven't had fast bowlers as captains because, you know, we need to really concentrate on what we're doing. And it's always just been a batsman. But I don't know why. I mean, I'd love to see Paddy break that mould because he's a gun fast bowler. He's a leader. He has the respect of everybody. Every time you see him interviewed, he speaks really well. And he's the sort of bloke you want to throw up there. But traditionally, no, we've just let the fast bowlers and the bowlers do their thing and not get involved. But, I mean, look, we're always talking to the skipper about field placings and when am I coming back on and how many overs do you want me to bowl and how the wicket's going and all that sort of stuff. So you're really involved in the game all the time. But, it's look, Michael, you were the captain. How big a job is it?
Yeah, it is weird. It's
I mean,
tough.
You're on 24/7, aren't you?
Yeah, seriously. You are. But that's my point. It's tough for whoever gets it. It's a full-time role, whether you're a batsman, whether you're a bowler. And these days, I believe you're seeing batsmen get injured just as much as bowlers. So I don't think it should matter what your role is in the team. If you're the best leader and the right leader, then you should get the opportunity.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. It's just this thing we've had about the fast bowlers.
Yeah, I know.
And it's just that's why it's created a lot of conversation about Paddy. I'd love to see him get the tick, but I want to say this too, boys. It doesn't matter which one gets it. They're a New South Wales blue bagger. And that's
I love it,
wonderful
Whit.
For us.
We'll talk about it. New South Wales, Whit. Tell me about Well, tell me about some of the sledges you may have... Well, you wouldn't have copped too many on the SCG, but like the Barmy Army when you were playing over there in England. What were they like? I mean, they weren't as established then, I suppose, as they are now, but you still would have copped plenty.
Copped plenty. That first test match, I remember very well at Old Trafford, and where I was playing Fleetwood, that was in Lancashire as well. It was about an hour's drive north of Manchester, so... When I rang the people back at Fleetwood to tell them I'd been picked in this test match, half of Fleetwood came down to Old Trafford the next day to watch me debut, which was wonderful. But I remember fielding on the fence and got told, I'm going to say it again, F off back to Fleetwood. plenty of time. You know, what's going on with your hair? they sang all day and they were... Oh, look, the English are a very generous crowd, but they love us and them, love playing over there. You just cop it. Now they send the army over here to bag us, which is so crazy. But it was just a wonderful time. And look, as I said, that series ended up being Botham's ashes. And it's gone down in history for what Beefy did. He was captain for the first couple of games and got nothing and was out of form. So they sacked him and bought Mike Brearley in, and all of a sudden Beefy... got a new lease of life and carved us up. And I feel quite humbled and privileged to think that I played two tests in Botham's ashes. It's crazy.
You played with some absolute legends and against some superstars. Who's the best you played with and against?
Oh, gee, pup, that's a big question. Look, I'll go the against first. I had the great privilege of playing a number of games against that great West Indian side. It's hard to go past Viv. I mean, you know, in his prime, which went for a long time, he was just so destructive. You know, he was a power hitter with a bat compared today was just a matchstick. And he was still, you know, people say to me things like this now, if Viv was playing nowadays with these bats, I go, mate, there was no ground that could have held him. He would have pumped them out of the ground over the stand. Don't worry about just over the fence. And he was so dominating. The moment he walked out of the gate onto the field, he had that swagger. He's chewing the gum. And he never wore a lid, ever. I've asked him about that. He said, with us, never owned a helmet. don't worry about never wore one. Never, ever had one in the kit. On top of that, there was Greenwich and Haynes at the top of the order, Richie Richardson, and Brian Lara came later. And these guys were just unbelievable.
Who'd want to be a bowler with?
Oh, mate, it was... You were worried about getting one in the forehead from the straight drive if you've got it on up. That's how hard they hit the ball. So, look, that was an amazing place. Plus, they had that array of fast bowlers, which was just scary but amazing to watch Michael, Malcolm, Joel Garner, Patrick Patterson, and then the list of 20 other guys that couldn't make the side that would have made any test side in the world. Best players I've played with? Oh, mate. Look, I played just in a New South Wales side a number of times that had Slater and Tubby at the top, Stephen and Mark Waugh, Michael Bevan. I mean, Mo Matthews, you know, Henry and myself bowling and Brad McNamara or Trevor Bayliss. Just unbelievable Sheffield Shield side. And then you get in the test side, and you're just playing with another level. Look, one of my favourite players to play with in all that time, and we were great mates, was Dean Jones. Dean changed the game. People talk about Dino and his one-day credentials. He changed one-day cricket, and Michael Bevan upped the ante very quickly as well with one-day cricket. But, mate, Dean made double centuries in Test cricket. Dean was just an unbelievable player. His energy, his love of the game. He just wanted to play and play and play and play. And I really enjoyed playing with Dino. But look, to play with Stephen and Mark, I mean, if you don't know they're brothers and twins, you wouldn't even know they were related. Two really different styles, unbelievable cricketers. I mean, Mark was just, if you saw Mark score 40, it was the best 40 you've ever seen, ever. So true. And then he'd take three catches in the slips that no one would have ever got a hand on. Then in his early days, he was quick as a seamer. Then he started bowling off. I hate these people that can do everything. And you didn't take the war boys on in golf, in tennis, anything with a ball, you didn't take them on. But they were just great players. We mentioned AB. I mean, I played with Merv and Billy McDermott. They were high-class fast bowlers. It was just a pleasure to be in those teams.
Well, you're a batsman, which you saved the test match against New Zealand for us.
I'm still reminding Sir Richard every time I see him, and it's one of the greatest days in my life because my batting average was like 5 or 6, and he was one of the greats of all time. And I've actually done a few speaking gigs with him, and that's been mentioned, and he genuinely says, because I said, the first time he said it, I said, did you really mean it? He said, it's the most disappointing day in his test cricket life, because he just thought 100% he was going to knock Billy McDermott or me over. They were going to win the test. It would have been a one-all draw then, and they would have retained the Trans-Tasman Cup. Well, and he never got us out. So every time I see him, I just wave, and he just puts his hands in his face and just ducks the head, goes, stop it, widow. It was 1987. I go, I'll remind you forever, Sir Richard, don't worry.
And as you should. And you took to your media career after your playing career like a duck to water. And have you got a favourite yarn, I guess, from being on tour with Sydney Weekender or behind the scenes with Who Dares Wins and Gladiators? What's one of your favourite memories from working on those shows?
Look, I've been at the Seven Network now for 27 years. I just cannot believe that all that time's gone. And all that time I've done Sydney Weekender. But early doors, there was Who Dares Wins and Gladiators. They were at the cutting edge of reality TV. There'd been no shows ever made or produced like that. And it set up reality TV, really. I'm really sorry for some of the stuff that's on there now. It's pretty ordinary. But it was cutting-edge stuff. The thing with Who Dares Wins was, if you remember, there was a $50 dare, then there was like a mini dare, then there was a main dare. And the main dare was a really big deal where we'd go and grab someone and throw them up a crane and they were frightened of heights or whatever it may be. We found very quickly that what was a really big deal in season one was now a $50 dare on the street. So it just kept upping the ante. And I remember many times they had a big whiteboard in the office of Mason Brand Entertainment, the show, the people that were producing it. And I'd walk in and look at this whiteboard and say, man to feed shark with chainmail glove on. And I'd go, but what about if the shark goes up to his elbow, he's going to swallow the chainmail glove and his forearm. Like, what? Really? Anyway, yep, we went up the bloody barrier reef and out we there was feeding sharks with a very small chainmail glove on. I'll never forget that. But it was an amazing show. And look, I'm still in contact with Tanya Zayeta. We're great friends. And she's got twins now, and I've got 27-year-old triplets. So I don't know if there was something in the water at Who Dares Wins, but we've had multiple births. Gladiators was hilarious. Gladiators was so physical that people got injured every time we filmed, but you didn't know that. The crowd didn't know that. But it was physical, it was tough. And again, at the cutting edge of reality TV, and I'm very, very humbled to have been at the start. But Sydney Weekender, what a job for a diehard New South Wales, Sydney-born blue bagger to host a show where you just get to travel around New South Wales for 27 years and see our amazing state. And it is an amazing state. We've got rainforest, desert, temperate climate, snow, absolutely everything in this state that you can see, and it's amazing.
Well, you put a smile on our faces, certainly since your playing career and also in your playing career, mate. Thanks so much for being our Friday legend this morning.
Jared, it's been a great ride, mate. Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you, Loz, and all the best, pup.
Good on your win.
See you, buddy.
See you, boys. Bye.